everybody. Welcome to a Friday edition Bulldog Hour and a little bit more. CG will join me for emails at 3 o'clock today. And prior to that, we'll talk to Daryl and Marcus as well. Bulldog baseball tonight. It is senior weekend as Fresno State, San Diego State at Biden-Bennett. And obviously important games for both teams, but the Bulldogs trying to seal up the number one seed. They're almost assuredly going to be 1-2, or at least they should be going in to Reno, but both, I guess, if you want to look at the headline, would be both are going to be there in Reno, contest things in a couple of weeks, and see who the automatic qualifier might be. Softball across the street against Boise State, it will not be the NC2As for the softball team. Maybe they'll get that NIT bid. We'll see about that. Also, track and field championships still going on, hosting the Mountain West. The Bulldogs are the host. They're out at Veterans Memorial Buchanan, and you can check GoBulldogs.com to get all that information about events and times and all of that. And hopefully the problematic weather will not bother things today. Interesting night last night, that's for sure. Now, the other thing I wanted to bring up, and we've talked about it the last week or so, but go to Facebook or to GoFundMe, look up in search engine Fishing McClure for Mason. This is the fundraiser that will take place on the 15th of June for Mason Frulli, who's an 11-year-old who is battling brain cancer, was in remission for a while. Unfortunately, tumor has come back, and we want to get whatever help we can for medical expenses, all of that. So if you can give, please do so. If you want to donate to that regatta, I think there's 80 boats last we checked, committed to things on the 15th of June. Do that. Do whatever you can. Our good friend Gary, his son Ryan, also involved in this. And obviously, I don't need to tell you the import of it. So hopefully, you can get involved. Again, June 15th is when it will take place. And for us, we'll always do whatever we can for not only our friends that do so much for the community, but also for someone like Mason in particular, because nobody should have to face this, but all of us that are parents understand that you don't want your kid going through this. So I hope you can get involved with that. Also, a couple other notes here. On Monday, we'll have our annual visit with Mario Andretti. We usually talk to Mario a little bit later, closer to the Indy 500, which is on the 26th, so it's 2 weeks away. But this is the month of Mario at Indy because it's the 50th anniversary of his win in 1969, and because of that, so much media coverage has been added on to things that we thought it's best to get to Mario, as we will on Monday. So I'll talk to Paul on Tuesday. Also, because NBC has taken over Indy, this is a relationship that ABC had forever. They are doing a special tomorrow about Mario Andretti, where they took he and Patty Reed, his publicist, back to Mario's original home in Italy, which was taken over during Nazi Germany time. So they're going to have him visit the detention camp that he lived in for 7 years as a kid. And I've been told already this is an amazing documentary. It's on NBC, The Mothership, tomorrow. And I'll get you that time, but I would like you to check that out because it has a lot to do with things beyond sport, that's for sure. And we'll talk to Mario live from Indy on Monday at 2:05. All right, guys, chance right now to talk to our good friend Daryl Howerton, who's nice enough to move whatever day I need him to move to. In this case, it's a Friday, and we'll talk some basketball right now with Daryl before we talk to Marcus. Daryl, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing just nifty, Daryl. Ought to be an interesting night. Now, look, you write for NBA.com, so you understand fully two things. One, the import of tonight at Toyota Center in Houston, and two, you understand my incredible frustration with the national media. Probably not in that order, right? But before we get to me complaining at you for about 10, just like every phone call we have off air, right? Okay, before we get there, a couple of things here that I wanted to address with you. First of all, the local guys in the NBA, let's start with Paul George. I brought this up. We were on air when the announcement came down that he had had the surgery on his shoulder. He also has a second surgery coming up. He's going to miss the start of training camp. Now, look, this is a guy you know that fought through catastrophic knee injury issues. I mean, he almost lost part of his leg, as we know, with that terrible accident playing for Team USA when they were in Vegas. Is this just something to clean things out? I know he was in a lot of pain. Or this, the repairing of the tendon and everything, is this critical, Daryl, in regard to his future? I mean, is this something that he just could not play through anymore? And is that all there was to it?
Right. I mean, when the season ended, they knew they were going to be addressing some things, and they needed to go about what was the best long-term way of addressing it. And this is it. We're seeing it right now. And, you know, everybody's hopeful for the best. You don't know until you go through these things. And we're probably not even going to get a better answer till August. And once we get that answer in August, we're not going to get a better answer on the other surgery and everything until October in training camp. So, you know, right now they're just doing the best they can, and this is the route they're going down. And everybody's anticipating him being, you know, at all-star level when everything sums up. But when he'll get back on the court, nobody exactly knows if it's going to be October, November, September, or whatnot. But they do think they'll have a better idea come August.
I've told you that I do wonder if he made the right decision. Westbrook also had surgery, by the way. Daryl, you and I have had this conversation. So I'm not going to go back through the whole thing again, but I know there were factors that involved the final decision being made the way it was made by PG-13. Part of it was he liked it in OKC. He likes his fishing, though. Like I said, he could fish in L.A. if he'd like to. Not downtown, but if he wants to go back to Palmdale stuff, he'd be fine. Also, he and Westbrook, another L.A. guy, get along great. But when he looks at the landscape right now and seeing what appears to be an OKC team that's getting farther and farther from shore, in all honesty, do you think he wonders about the decision he made, or is he young enough still that he can have another contract somewhere else, and if it doesn't work out in OKC in regard to a title, he's fine to chase it somewhere else? What do you think his point of view is right now?
Oh, I think you've asked me this question before, but the answer keeps on changing with every week, with every month.
That's why I keep asking you.
With every Laker disastrous mistake they make. Well,
that's where I'm headed. See, you see through me, Daryl, you know, right where I'm going. It's the old setup.
Exactly.
You know this. That's
exactly.
Ask the first question
right,
because you
net,
want the fourth. Yes. Yeah.
I'm at the
you
net
know
with
the deal.
Volleyball, and no one's there to block it. So I'm like,
let me explain something. Because Daryl interviews people for a living for NBA.com. You know how it works. It's really question four or five that you want to get to, but you got to get to one, two, three, and four before you can ask the one you really want. So, yes, okay, let's go to the one that I really want. Go ahead. Tell me about it.
Exactly, and the behind-the-scenes thing is, I know you're asking this question because of what's transpired with the Lakers this past week.
Yes.
And that just makes Paul George feel all the better about the decision he made. The advice that his agent Aaron Mintz gave him was, they just don't handle things in professional manners there. I'd feel bad if we signed there. It's going to be bad. I know you want to go there. It's kind of like the old David Letterman advice he got from Johnny Carson. I know you've always wanted the Tonight Show,
right?
But this is not the Tonight Show that you want. This is not your dream. You know, there's times you have to move on for your dream, and that's my advice. Because Aaron Mintz realized the agent for Paul George, the agent for D'Angelo Russell, the agent for Julius Randle, that the Lakers and Magic Johnson and the Buss family, you know, were screwing them over as far as giving them, you know, bad business practices when it came to Russell, when it came to Randle. And it looked like the same thing was about to happen with Paul George. I mean, they weren't bending over backwards trying to get him before. And, you know, he advised, let's not do this. The Thunder appeared this great. Sam Presti's been professional. And Paul George realized that was great advice, you know, and he went with it. And I think when you see the way they treated Tyronn Lue this past week, when you saw what happened with Monty Williams before that, you saw the fiasco with Luke Walton and Magic Johnson. Every week that goes on, every month that goes on this past offseason, you know, like we said a couple of weeks ago, and the reason you're asking me this today, you know, it just gets more and more and more sure that he made the right decision.
You're right. The reason I'm asking is to find out that Ty Lue was told that he'd have to put Kurt Rambis on his staff. I also understood they suggested somebody like Jason Kidd who wants the job. That's the kind of guy you want on your staff, all right, someone who wants the job. But the perception is that Jeannie Buss, and this has been repeated a million times, and I bring it up because the Lakers are on our station. They are important to us. Jeannie Buss's best buddy is Kurt Rambis's wife, Linda, and the thought is you put Kurt in there, and then everything that Ty Lue does in regard to favoritism toward LeBron, if he and LeBron are, the fear from the Buss family is evidently that LeBron's going to try to take over the franchise and move it. I don't know where he's going to move it to Toledo, Ohio, maybe, is where he wants to go with it, right? Back to Minneapolis, a major surprise to the Timberwolves. The Lakers are going back home. Whatever it is, I know that Ty Lue perceived it as you want to spy on the staff. It's a really, as you said, unhealthy environment. And I guess if you're Paul George, and your Letterman comparison, I think, is very apt because you are aware, since you brought it up, that when NBC went with Leno, and Letterman asked Carson, what would you do if you were me? He said, I'd sign with CBS because the offer was there, and that's kind of what you're saying, right? It was,
yeah,
I'd
yeah.
sign with OKC, and that was a good decision. We'll see what happens, but I will ask you, in Dysfunction Junction, which is the Laker front office right now, who is it that's going to go, who's worth a damn, that's going to go into that as a coach, a head coach, into that environment knowing there's already inherent mistrust between the Laker ownership front office group and LeBron? Who is going to get in the middle of that? Because it's apparent that's really at the core of this, right?
Right. I mean, basically now you're down to your third tier of coaches. I mean, they had a first level of guys they were going after, like Mike Krzyzewski and other coaches of that ilk they wanted, you know, for the job. And those guys didn't even take a phone call. It got down to the next level where they're looking at the best, you know, new coaches, assistant coaches, or guys who maybe had a try before. And those guys were Monty Williams, Tyronn Lue, and people like that. Now you're getting to the third level of coaches, guys who once were in the league and now out and will sign three-year contracts. They just want to get back in the league again. And people like Frank Vogel and the people who are interviewing for the jobs right now, that's where they're at right now, but they're not getting their first choices. They're not getting their second choices. Right now, they're getting people who do have NBA experience, but they're also coaches that will take a head coaching job at any place. And that's what the Lakers have become right now. They become any place USA. I mean, Phoenix Suns were picked above them. The Sacramento Kings were picked above them. Luke Walton would rather go to the Kings than stay with the Lakers. Monty Williams chose the Suns over the Lakers. Tyronn Lue chose nobody over the Lakers. So that's kind of where the Lakers are at right now. And really, no coaching change or GM change is going to make things better, because right now the problem is with ownership. And the only solution I see to the matter is if the Buss ownership group sells out their ownership, you know, shares to people like the, say, the Kardashians and Jenners. If they buy the team, they'll probably become better off.
Oh, geez. Okay, there is a damning statement. I thought you were going to say the only thing you could save him if Dr. Buss were to return from the dead. That might be it. Because I'm going to tell you right now, thank you very much. Drive safely, everybody. I'm here all week. I mentioned this about Pat Riley. You know, they say Pat longs for his home in Malibu, which he only gets to, I guess, you know, use his web portal to take a, he's got his Ring doorbell to see what's going on there, right? But I think he can live without Malibu for another couple of years, because there's no way in the world he's putting himself in that position. All right, that having been said, we can hardly wait for the Lakers season to start next October. Here's a promo for you. Okay, I did want to ask you, since we're talking about coaches, about Justin Hudson. You and I talked off air about Baker visiting Fresno State. Whether he's going to land here or not, who knows? But we know this for sure. This is a guy that was recruited by Hutt when Hutt was at San Diego State, so he has the relationship. He's done an amazing job so far. But you were telling me, people, you and I have talked about it on air, but it kind of goes on by, that there are some NBA connections that Hutt is very proud of in this coaching staff, right? Guys like the Greek Freak find themselves in this town in the offseason, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's fun watching these NBA playoffs, because not only do we have Coach Ron Adams, you know, the Golden State Warriors on the assistant coaching staff there, or Brooke Lopez with the Milwaukee Bucks, you know, went to San Joaquin Memorial and played high school ball out here. But you also have the coaches' connections, the coaches that we've become close to at Fresno State, Justin Hudson or Keith, Keith Brown, all these assistant coaches that have worked with players over the years. Even, I mean, all the assistants, whether it's Marvin Adams to the Sheltons, they've worked with various players. But right now at this playoff time, it's especially nice when you see someone like Pascal Siakam and his relationship with Coach Brown and doing so well with the Toronto Raptors. And on that same team, you see Kawhi Leonard, who was close to Coach Hudson when he was the person who recruited him to San Diego State, and the decade-long relationship those guys have had and doing so well, that these two men really feel like proud papas, these assistant head coach at Fresno State. It's kind of become an adopted team of Fresno State, the Raptors, because of what they have there. Not to mention the Bucks are an adopted team of Fresno, with Giannis spending his summers out here in Fresno playing basketball because his longtime girlfriend is out here. And you also have Brooke Lopez and his ties. So it's really going to be an interesting series if the Raptors are able to beat the 76ers to make it a Milwaukee-Toronto series, because on that end we'll have that. And on the West Finals end, if Golden State holds up their end of the bargain, Coach Adams will be back in his fifth straight NBA Finals.
And that's a big if, and we're going to get to that in a second. I'm also going to talk to Marcus about it. But I did want to bring up, since you brought up Kawhi Leonard, one more time, the circumstances that Steve Fisher shared with us when Steve was on air recommending Hutt for the job here. We talked to Steve a couple of times, and he had said that it was, as you referenced, Justin Hudson, who told Steve Fisher, because this Kawhi Leonard was not as heavily recruited as you would think, watching a guy who's one of the three or four best players in the world right now. At the time, Hutt saw him and went back to Steve Fisher in San Diego and said, there's a guy in L.A. we need to take a look at. And Fish said, hey, you know what? If you're saying that, then let's get in the car and go take a look. And they signed Kawhi Leonard right then. And look, we saw Kawhi throughout his career, and he was a great player at San Diego State. But, Daryl, in fairness to everybody else, I don't know that anybody thought that Kawhi Leonard's offensive game would round out. We knew he could play defense, but I don't think anybody thought his offensive game was going to become what it has. I would say this. He was great in college. He is exponentially better now. Is that fair to say?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, if I can toot my own horn, we run a draft preview every year at Hoop Magazine. And in the 2011 NBA draft preview, I ranked Kawhi Leonard as the third best player in the group. He actually got drafted 15th. But the reason I put him third was all because of something that Steve Fisher said. And that was everybody criticized Kawhi Leonard for not being the three-point shooter. He needed to have that in the NBA. And he got criticized that he couldn't shoot outside, he couldn't do this, he couldn't do that. And Coach Fisher told me, it's not that he can't do it. It's just that I didn't want him doing it because he was our center. We had him playing in the paint, all his shots coming in the paint.
Right.
Trust me, if I wanted him to be a three-point shooter, he would have led our conference in three-point shooting. He would have been there every morning, every night, shooting hundreds and thousands of jumpers every day, and he would have become the best three-point shooter that we had. But I needed him as a center, so that's what he worked at. And if the Spurs are looking for a shooter, by gosh, by the time the season starts, they're going to have themselves a great shooter. And that's exactly what we've seen. He's become a great shooter. So knowing that he had that type of work ethic, Fisher said that he was the hardest worker he ever had. And that includes the Fab Five tandem of, Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, Jalen Rose, et cetera.
Right.
So knowing all that information, I was like, this guy's a can't miss. So the Spurs got a steal when they got him at number 15. He did have all the you could have seen it coming had you had Coach Fisher's insight, but you're right. 99% of the people out there didn't see it coming, including the scouts who let him drop out of the lottery.
It's a great answer, Daryl. Another reason I love talking to you is you can lead me right into my next topic. We don't even go over this in advance. But since you brought up the three-point line, I'm going to get back to my wonderful idea of the symmetrical 25-foot elliptical line for the NBA. I'll do that with CG at the 3 o'clock hour where I've told you what I want. I want them to take center of the hoop, go out with a tape measure, 25 feet straight away above the top of the key and beyond by about 3 feet, and then let it go around in an elliptical shape. Wherever it tails off to on the sideline, that's where your three-point line stops. No corner stuff. a 25-foot line that doesn't go all the way around because we're not going to widen the court. I'm talking, I would love for them to do that, but they're not going to do that right now and take all those very expensive seats out. But a line that would be halfway around the outside, give you your three at 25, and also give you the intermediate mid-range game. That's me solving the NBA. I got that whip. But now I notice the colleges are going to back the line up. That's the proposal. I think it'll be approved. They're going to back it up a foot. You and I have talked about this. Daryl, is that enough? Is it enough to back it up a foot, or do they need to go back big time to 23-9 where the NBA is right now at the top?
Well, Tony, you'll be happy to know that in today's column in hoopbag.com, readers
uh-huh.
out there,
imagine that.
I actually stole your idea.
Okay,
I stole
you.
Your idea.
Thank you very much.
Put it in as, and put it in as one of my 10 recommended rule changes to make the game better. It's the perimeter three-point shot. It's 25 feet. And due to space reasons, I couldn't give Tony all the credit he deserves, so I'm going to do it now.
Due to space reasons. You sound like me when somebody goes, didn't Daryl say that on air? I said, yeah, but I didn't have time to say Daryl Howerton. That takes a long time, so I had to leave
exactly.
that out from time constraints. So
and
for
Tony
you, not enough column inches. Oh, jeez. We're both shameless. That's why we get along so well. Let me ask you a specific about the college game. Is it going to be good enough to back it up a foot? Is that good enough, in your opinion, for the colleges, period? Never mind the NBA.
No, they need to do more. Everybody needs to
yeah.
do more. It's gotten out of proportion. 25 feet is a start. And if it takes – my ideal setting would be to 25 feet all the way around, make the court wider, but you can't do that because of court side, considerations.
Yes.
So the next best solution is what you have, the perimeter three-point shot, which is brilliant because it would open up the post-up game again. It would open up the mid-range jumper, and it would also give the three-point shot its proper consideration when it comes to weighted scoring. And when you first gave me that idea, the perimeter thing, I actually thought that, I thought it was a good idea, but it really took a week to sink in. I kept on thinking, that's really a great idea. That's really what the game needs. And I thought about all the other possibilities it breaks up. So what you're saying about college basketball, it's good. It's a Band-Aid to the problem. The real solution is coming up with what you have. It's making the perimeter three-point shooting. That solves a lot of problems and creates a lot of good things. And I think that's what both college basketball and pro basketball could use right now. High school, you could keep it the same. But I bet you even in time they would adopt those changes, once they saw how good it was for college and the pros.
Yeah, me and Goldsberry at ESPN, the two of us want to
I read about Sprawl Ball after your
that's right, afterward, yes. I've got to get him on the air because he's a kindred spirit, that's for sure. All right. The difference is he might actually have power to enact change. With me, I'm just, what I'm doing. I'm just yodeling.
You started the whole thing,
well.
Tony. You started the whole
yes.
thing.
Sure, I did. Yeah, no doubt about it. All right, want to
you
ask
were there
you
with
real
Naismith,
quick.
I heard.
Yeah, see, I know this. See, this is the problem. This is why I'm loath to take credit for anything, lest it turns into this. Weren't you the guy, Tony, who told Naismith, get rid of the peach basket? Weren't
cut
you
the
guy?
The
yes.
That the bottom out the basket.
That's right. Jeez. Honest. I'm the guy who said, how about we play on donkeys? And look what happened in all the high schools now. All right. By the way, I love that. I've forgotten what rural school had donkey basketball again, and they thought it was some sort of newsflash. I got news for you. McLean in 1972, we were riding donkeys at that time, too. All right, so it's not a new idea. Trust me. You just don't want to be the guy. You don't want to be the shovel attendant at the games, if you know what I'm saying. All right. Boy, I really have taken it down to a new low, haven't I? It's a Friday. This is what happens. I did want to ask you about tonight, because I'm going to talk to Marcus about it. Daryl, there's an interesting dynamic going on here. The Rockets, after spending the better part of 10 months telling us how the injury to Chris Paul cost them a chance, and they're very subtle about it, but not like they shared it with the national media or anything. You know how I feel about that. But now Tillman Fertitta, the owner, on the jump today, and basically said, you know what, I don't think Kevin Durant being out makes any difference. Okay, Daryl, let me share this with you, okay? Chris Paul is a very good player. The Warriors were without Andre Iguodala after Game 3, though the national media can't seem to figure out when he was out, if he was out. They just needed to look up the box scores, but I guess that's too much work. Another editorial comment. But I understand the import of Chris Paul. to the Rockets last year. But for the owner of the Rockets to proffer the preposterous notion that not only the Warriors' best player, but right now the best player in the world, that his loss is not a difference maker, tells me one of two things going on with the Rockets. Either they have ownership that is truly delusional, or they've got an owner that desperately, after they inexplicably could not beat the Warriors with essentially a one-possession game when Durant went out with 14 minutes to go in that game, that you've got an owner that's trying to take pressure off his team for fear that a Rocket team that has, in all candor, choked a number of times, including to your Spurs, in the last few years in the playoffs, that Fertitta is either delusional or he's trying to somehow mitigate the we have no excuse for losing routine. Which one is it? Or is it a combination of the two?
I would hope it's more of the latter. I mean, I would think it would be that, because he's right in the sense that the Warriors are a dangerous team with or without Durant. They still are capable of winning one of two games with Curry, Clay, Iguodala. That they have a strong team that might be the strongest team still. But obviously, Kevin Durant was their best player at the time, so obviously it's a huge loss. But one thing you have to not only let your own players know, but also let the world know that this is still a dangerous team. This is still a team that won the 2015 NBA championship, you know, without Kevin Durant. This is a team that can still get it done. And we're going to see these role players who were struggling under their current roles maybe adopt some of their previous roles, like Jonas Jerebko playing in Durant's stead. You'll see Andrew Bogut probably play more, or maybe get a chance to play, maybe not. But you're going to see a lot of things change with the way the Warriors look Friday night. And in that sense, they'll be dangerous, because all they have to do is win one game Friday or Sunday, and then they advance. So in that sense, I hope that's what the owner was talking about in the way that he phrased it, even if he may have misphrased a thing or two.
Well, look, I understand, and I know we're going to hear a lot about, and it was brought up, you know, don't forget they were 73-9. Yeah, also, the year prior, the 2015, the 14-15 year, the title, the first one around, you had not only were these players 4 years younger, particularly the Livingstons and the Iguodalas. Livingston really has seen now, I think, the wear and tear coming right out of high school show, because he is not the same guy. But they don't have the depth. They do not have the David Lees. They certainly don't have a starter like Harrison Barnes. They don't have the Mo Buckets, Mo Spates coming off the bench. They don't have the Azeelis. They don't have a lot of these guys. And also, keep in mind for the Warriors, Damian Jones may come back, but he's been out all year. Boogie Cousins, even though he was a major factor when they did beat the Rockets without Durant in the regular season in February, the last time, by the way, the Rockets lost at home, that was a different Warrior team because Boogie was there. I guess what I'm saying is, if I were Fertitta, I might do the same thing, Daryl, so I'm not criticizing him. But I do find it a little odd that now we're hearing that the Warriors are somehow better off without Durant, and Durant is alienated by the Warrior behavior. None of that is true. What the Warriors are trying to do right now is put a brave face on a tough situation, because I'll tell you, as much as I love this team, as objective as I can be, there is no good reason that the Rockets shouldn't win the next two games, because now a great defender like Tucker can go after a Curry or a Thompson. The Warriors do not have that other option. They can trap more. They certainly have more depth. There is no reason in the world that the Rockets shouldn't win this series. And when you go back to last year, let's keep something in mind. And again, this is something people have handily forgotten about, my friend. Yes, Chris Paul was out. But not only was Iguodala out, in Game 6, the Rockets had a 17-point lead at the end of the first quarter in Oakland, and not much is brought up about that. They had a 15-point lead in Game 7, and that's when they missed 27 straight. What I'm saying is the Rockets have some issues, Daryl, that went beyond CP3 being out, and I just think there's a lot of covering of the tracks. Because if there's one thing the Warriors have going for them right now, if they lose, it's because Durant wasn't there. If the Rockets lose, Daryl, I will ask you, does it turn into a catastrophe? Does Fertitta, who doesn't quite have the stomach that Lacob does for luxury tax, does Fertitta start to change his mind about things if the Rockets can't get it done with Durant out? What do you say?
Well, I don't think so. I think they took their gamble with Chris Paul, and they've got to say it worked out because they got to the Final Four last year, and now they're facing off the Warriors again in a long series. So I don't think they can look at it as a failure, even if they come up short and come up empty. I know there's going to be people out there that criticize them for it, but in my mind, they went toe-to-toe with, you know, with Muhammad Ali like Joe Frazier did, and Frazier's one of the greatest heavyweights ever for doing so. So even if they come out on the short end and don't win a majority of the fights, you know, I look at them as a great champion. Now, there's other people who will be critical about it, but right now I'm just looking at this series being a wonderful, wonderful matchup. It's the best second-round series I've ever seen in my life. It's like an NBA Finals. We're getting to taste it early. And one thing that I'm really looking forward to is how the Rockets use their three-guard, four-guard lineups to make the Warriors use, you know, utilize their lack of depth by overplaying Curry, by overplaying Clay. They overplayed Kevin Durant, and the load just – he couldn't keep up with the load anymore. He scored a lot of points, played 44, 43, 49 minutes, 44 minutes, and he really scored as many points as Clay and Curry combined, I believe, in some of those games, most of those games. And they – by Houston playing three- and four-guard lineups like they never have before – they forced the Warriors to go to their lack of guard depth, and that really hurt them. They were playing 30 minutes per game. They actually stole the idea from the Clippers, who were doing it first. And by overplaying their three-guard lineups, they were able to get the Warriors to overplay Sean Livingston, Quinn Cook, Alphonso McKinney, basically 30 minutes per game. Those guys, those three guys were combined and played. And now they're getting at the Warriors again with that. So I don't know if they're going to be able to keep up. As you mentioned, their lack of depth is hurting the Warriors this year. So it's going to be fun to see how it affects the team now, you know, that Durant is out forward. How do they compensate it with more guard play? Do they compensate it with bringing some centers back? You know, who knows how it's going to shape up? But the Rockets right now have the Warriors on the heels, even though the Warriors landed some haymakers to get back in the series by winning a very close game five.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. It's going to be very interesting. Interesting how this finish, whatever it might be, might impact Durant's decision to come back or not. There's some crazy stuff going to happen in the next 48 hours. I'm looking forward to it, Daryl. I will tell you this, though. There is no reason in the world that the Rockets shouldn't win this series. And if they don't, they are going to get ass-hammered by the national media on Monday. That's all there is to it, fair or unfair. That's the bottom line. We'll see. I just don't know where the Warrior offense is going to come from if they can lock down Curry and Thompson and make guys like Iguodala and guys like, well, Green from the outside try to beat them. We'll see what happens. Daryl, appreciate it. Hope people visit hoopmag.com, NBA.com. We'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Thank you, Tony.
All right, guys. Daryl Howerton, take a break. Come back with Marcus, then CG. Bulldog Baseball tonight at 5:30 on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. 2:41 here until 3:30. Bulldog Baseball at 5:30 today. The Giants are back home. They'll be over on 790 as the Reds and Giants do battle after. Is that game over with yet from yesterday? If you lose 12-11, you don't have to tell people where you were. They'll know which park you were in if you lose a game 12-11, which with the Giants managed to do in Coors yesterday while it was snowing. So, again, had it been a warm day, goodness only knows how many runs would have been scored. Luckily, the Giants held them to 12. Unbelievable. The other thing is I had mentioned that Mario Andretti with us for the yearly visit coming up this Monday. Drive Like Andretti, that's the documentary on NBC, will be at 11 o'clock in the morning tomorrow. They've released part of it already on the Internet, but this is the full story. And like I said, back home to where he grew up, a lot of great stuff, and I urge people to watch it at 11 o'clock in the morning, our time tomorrow, prior to the Sharks, who will play on NBC at 5 o'clock tomorrow. And then we'll talk to Mario about Indy, his 50th anniversary, the win, and all that stuff, and our yearly visit on Monday at 2:05. All right, chance right now to talk to our great friend Marcus Grant, the king of fantasy NFL Network, NFL.com, and a guy who is desperately trying to get more than 20 minutes of sleep at a time. Let's bring up new daddy. How you doing? You're not Daddy Yankee. You're not there with Luis Fonsi, but you're close. How are you? Don't have a hit record yet, but you may have some ideas that go through your head in the middle of the night that you'd like to scream, Marcus. How about that? How are things going with the youngin? How's it going?
Well, you know, it's funny. You talk about no sleep, but I actually did turn on and watch the Giants for a little bit yesterday, which is like the first time I've actually...
Out like a light?
It's like, I was pretty peaceful. I'll also say that I think I watched it and like six different guys came to the plate before I saw somebody on that team that I recognized. Like that's, I guess that's where the Giants are nowadays.
That's what Bochy said in the post game, by the way. He had no idea. Oh man. I'll tell you, they're going to be right there at the end though. You watch. You watch what's going on in October. Yeah, okay. They'll be watching too. So you watch. They'll have this. They'll have their tea times ready at Blackhawk. Everything will be fine.
Well, here's the good news about that is that once October hits, that will cut down on traffic around there with, you know, the Chase Center or whatever it is opening up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Giants won't be in the way.
The ATM is there. And it better be. It better be an ATM for them. They are actually in a position, Marcus, where if they were to sign everybody to the max contracts, their luxury tax will be greater than their payroll, and their payroll is already ridiculous. So, like I was saying, we were just talking about that Tillman Fertitta, the owner of the Rockets. You know, he's a casino owner, right, in Vegas. And he doesn't quite have the stomach for what Joe Lacob does. But even with the Warriors, Peter Guber, the Warrior co-owner, who is a Hollywood producer, as you're well aware. He asked you many times to be in movies, I know. It's either that or, well, there's another guy who asked you to be in a movie, but, you know, that was last name of Jeremy, I believe. Big compliment, I understand. But Peter Guber has said that he needs reassuring because Joe Lacob likes to spend a lot of money. So you can imagine the hesitancy about how things are going if this team is not what it's supposed to be when we get to October. Which does beg the question, since I started it with Daryl, and this is a Friday leading up to a huge game tonight, where are you at in this? I have said this, and it's not me being fatalistic. I'm just trying to be honest about it. I don't see how Houston can justifiably say it's anything but a monster disappointment if they lose this series right now, Marcus, yet they're already trying to walk it back in the great Southwest, in the eastern part of the wonderful state of Texas, by saying, hey, you know what? The Warriors won with this team in 2015, which is a bunch of hooey. What's going on here? Do they really mean that, or are they trying to build in an excuse before even get to it?
Yeah, you know, I feel like the Rockets this series, you know, between leaking data information about fouls that may or may not have been called or should have been called, and now this, it just... You know, it does seem like they are sort of trying to pad their excuses in case something goes wrong here. I mean, I was sort of, and maybe this is me being, you talk about being fatalistic, maybe this is me being a fatalistic Warriors fan. I was worried about the Warriors' chances after those two games in Houston just because they looked so bad and you know, the guys beyond Kevin Durant hadn't shown up. And this was before Durant got hurt. I thought the Rockets still had a solid chance to come to Oakland and take one of these games. So, you know, if they somehow don't get it done, knowing that KD's not playing either, they have to consider this a huge and especially for Daryl Morey, whose whole reason d'etre right now is to beat the Golden State Warriors. If this isn't their opportunity, then I just don't know what is.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, and this is why I look at this thing and say, okay, you got an owner that's trying at the moment to create this illusion that, hey, oh, look out, we could still lose, when in reality, I think you've got almost a concession about a Game 7 coming up. And I will ask you, I brought this up, I didn't ask Daryl about it on air, Howardson, a moment ago, but I talked about it off air, Marcus. If Steve Kerr had his druthers right now, do you think that he would like to pull a Popovich and just leave everybody home? I know he didn't, but leave everybody home for this game and say, you know what, I'm going to send the bench there and we'll rest the Iguodalas and the Livingstons and the Greens and everybody for a Game 7 at home? Do you really think that Steve Kerr is going to go you-know-what to the wall tonight to try to win, or are they going to play obligatory minutes because it's on national TV and just wait for Game 7?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sure, maybe he would like to in a perfect world, but also you got to know that fine coming from Adam Silver will be substantial if they were to do that in a playoff series. I get the feeling that tonight you will see the starters play heavy minutes, but, you know, if we get to it and it's the fourth quarter and the Rockets have a double-digit lead, I would imagine those guys are going to sit really quickly in anticipation of a game seven. I don't see a situation where if the Warriors fall behind by, you know, say double digits or whatever, that Kerr is going to want to make a serious push, because the worst thing you could do is really exhaust these guys, lose the game, and still have to come home and play a game seven shorthanded. So, you know, I mean, especially with obviously losing Durant is huge, but maybe just as big as the fact that it kills what little depth they had to begin with. So I just don't see them really extending guys unless somehow it looks like they actually have a chance to steal this one.
Yeah, and I think that is exactly 100% the case, just what you're saying. If you go start of the game, you know this, we're going to see, first of all, we're going to see Houston try to trap Curry and Thompson. But let's say that one of the two just goes off and has one of those halves. If you get, like you said, into the third, start of the fourth, and you're in the hunt, obviously at that point you're going to say, we're going to see if we can do what we did at home the other night, right, which was find a way to gut one out. But if it gets to 10, 12, what have you, knowing you had a four-hour flight in, and then you're going to have to turn right around, have a four-hour flight out, and not only that, Marcus, but the game on Sunday starts at 12:30 Pacific, so you don't even have 48 hours. Now, it's the same for the Rockets, but the Rockets have more depth, and I think there's no question that if things start to get away in the fourth quarter, they are not going to just spend it all trying to win the game. That having been said, I had said before, I'll say it again, I don't think Houston has a single excuse for not winning this series right now, particularly with all the rhetoric that came out about the Chris Paul injury last year. I think they put themselves in a position of saying, we spent the better part of a year saying we lost only because of Chris Paul's hamstring. Now the best player in the world is out. How can you say anything but we have no excuse if we don't win this thing?
It's hard. I mean, you know, because the Rockets, you know, Durant right now is playing out of his mind, but the Rockets have the guy who very well could be the MVP for the second straight year. They've got Chris Paul, who is, you know, still one of the top point guards in the league. They've gotten solid performances off the bench. I mean, you know, P.J. Tucker has played well. I mean, literally everything has sort of come together for the Rockets in this series. And then, you know, add for them what is, you know, for the Warriors an unfortunate injury. For them, it just seems to be an opportunity. So if they don't take advantage of this, I don't know that anyone's going to listen to whatever excuses they may have after the series is over.
Well, I know the wonderfully understated Stephen A. Smith is certainly going to be all over him. And I do have to ask you, because I've talked this week already with CG about the national media, and I was talking to Daryl about it off air the other day, to the point that I think he wanted to hang up on me in the first couple of minutes, but was too nice a guy to do it, and I don't blame him, because I wanted to hang up on me, to be honest about it. But I was telling him that I thought that the national media at times, and this is part of my West Coast bias, right, because you and I both grew up out here, and we know what happens. And I understand that these games, which are in prime time for us, are starting at 10:30. I mean, to ask Tony Kornheiser to be up at 10:30 at night for the start of a game. You know, old Mr. Tony's not making it to the national anthem when there's a 10 o'clock or 10:30 start Eastern time. I get it that it's more difficult, but I also know, as opposed to the old days before mini dishes and whatever, where it was hard to hunt down games, they're all there with the season passes, right, for all the sports. They're right there. You can go back and watch them and archive and everything else. They seem on the East Coast to know so little about what's going on out here at night. Does it bother you the way it bothers me? This whole thing about not being able to figure out whether Andre Iguodala played or not last year against the Rock. How hard is it to go look it up, man? I mean, come on. You know, I mean, it got to the point that even Mike Breen, who I respect a great deal, he's a wonderful play-by-play guy, right? And he spends a lot of time around the league because he's not only the lead voice for ABC, but he is also, you know, the New York Knicks lead voice on Madison Square Garden. He's around the league. He actually said, last week. You know, Steve Kerr had to remind us that Andre Iguodala didn't play against the Rockets last year in the playoffs. Well, you know what? I can guarantee you Steve Kerr didn't remind him of that because Andre Iguodala did play the first three games, and the Warriors dominated two of the three. And then Iguodala got hurt and was out, and either they don't recognize it or they don't. Rachel Nichols came out, and she's out here, so she didn't have an excuse. She's down by you in L.A. She came out and said, well, you know, Andre didn't get back till the end of the series. Wrong again. I mean, am I too hard on these people because I follow this team so closely? Or is there this crazy thing called the Internet where all you have to do is hit a keyboard a couple of strokes and you find information? It's a magical thing. Am I really pounding too hard on these guys?
Well, I think that last point is maybe the most salient one. The fact that, you know, Google is readily available and free for everyone. You know, like, I get if you are covering the league as a whole, right? And, yep. And you see however many games. And yes, those sort of things, especially a year removed, sort of slip your mind. But the fact that, you know, if you are, especially if you're doing a national broadcast or a national telecast, that you wouldn't bother to go back and, you know, check the box scores. Yeah, it's as simple as checking the box scores and seeing who got minutes.
Yep.
I think that's the part that is understandably frustrating, especially for Warriors fans.
All right, that's enough complaining from me for an hour. I apologize to all of you non-Warrior fans about it. It's pent-up frustration. They got to win some titles, Mark, because I've been waiting too damn long. Never mind. All right, as I let you go, my friend, I hope people visit NFL.com and check things out, Fantasyland with the King of Fantasy. What happens tonight and or Sunday? What happens with the series, in your opinion?
I think we go to a game seven. I wouldn't be surprised if the Warriors keep this thing interesting for, you know, a half or three quarters, but I just don't think they have enough depth. And so unless someone off the bench plays huge, I think we go to a game seven. And, you know, I'm gonna maybe go with my heart here and say they figure out a way to pull one out, and that Oracle still has a little bit of life left in it for you know, for at least one more series.
And then, as I bid you adieu until next week, with Durant, any bearing at all on his decision to stay or go if they lose now as opposed to winning? Any bearing?
No, I mean, I don't know. He may say that after the fact. I really believe that he has not totally made up his mind yet. But I think, I don't know what it'll be about the series. I think it'll just be more about, you know, how much the Warriors sort of woo him, whether or not he wants that, and, you know, or whether or not the Knicks put together a solid sales pitch. And, you know, I don't know, maybe they try their own Hamptons five. They get Kyrie and a couple other guys to head out there to the Hamptons and see if they can woo him again.
I think you're right about that. And appreciate it. Tell little Emery, said hello. Talk to you next week. Take care.
Will do. Take care, Tom.
All right, guys. Take a break. Come back. Wrap up hour one on 50,000 Watt 940 ESPN. Everybody, welcome back. Thanks again to Russ, of course, for his time here in our 1 CG coming up. We'll go over emails until 3:30. Bulldogs come up at 5:30 tonight. Also, thanks to Daryl and Marcus as well. Remind you guys again, it's senior weekend at Biden-Bennett and a chance for Fresno State to really solidify first place. Hope you're out there. If not, across the street for softball, or how about both? This is KFIG Fresno. Buddy, welcome back. Got about 20, 25 minutes with you. We'll go over emails with good friend Christopher Gabriel in just a moment. Remind you, schedule for the rest of the day, 5:30. Ball will be up from Biden-Bennett. 6 o'clock, the first pitch or thereabouts, as the first of three with San Diego State. Senior weekend, Bulldogs will wrap up the regular season in Las Vegas against UNLV next weekend. These two teams, Fresno State, San Diego State, are going to make the Final Four. The Bulldogs very much want to be the regular season champion going into the automatic berth proceedings that we will see in Reno as Memorial Day weekend rolls through. Giants are back home after that game yesterday that we're going to get to in just a second. I know for Christopher, I mean, he had to wait and wait to get his show on the air. Boy, I've been there with this club. But the Giants are back home, and they'll have a 6:35 pre, 7:15 first pitch as the Reds have been in California beating the Giants here because they played the A's after the two teams, the Giants and Reds, played back in Cincinnati. Also, one other reminder, I had mentioned it before, tomorrow 11 o'clock on NBC on the Mothership. Sharks will be on at 5 o'clock, by the way, tomorrow on NBC. Drive with Mario Andretti, that great documentary that was done with Mario going back to his original home in Italy. It's a wonderful piece and has a lot to do with things beyond sport. And again, Mario will be with us 2:05 on Monday for our annual visit. All right, chance to bring up our good friend Christopher Gabriel. Of course, Monday through Thursday, 3 to 6 with CGP, and Friday morning, 7 to 9, and nice enough to come back because he's a glutton for punishment. Come back on Friday afternoon. Christopher, how you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, you mentioned yesterday's game that I think was, you think the full game time was 6 hours and 37 minutes. wasn't it Herm Edwards who said, you play to win the game, you don't play to score 11 runs and lose the game? I think Herm said that.
He also said, baseball takes too long. No, so, you know what, let's do this.
Yeah.
He didn't say that, although, you know, he did grow up a Giant fan. Herm, as you know, is from Monterey.
That's right.
I want to start with Joey. Again, TDAD1 at ATT.net. We'll have time, I hope, to get through three or four of our ever-growing list. But Joey said after sitting through the four-hour-long slugfest/yawn fest between the Giants and Rockies, I grudgingly concede that substantive changes must be made to my favorite sport. But I simply don't believe that any of the proposed changes proffered by the so-called experts are workable. He goes on to say, Joey does, they either don't really make much of a difference or they would change far too much of the actual nature and beauty of the game. So, gentlemen, he asks, what are we longtime baseball loyalists to do? You and I have been around the block on this about 5,000 times. Let's make it 5,001, CG. I had mentioned to you the last time, I've almost gotten to the point after the tweaking and looking at this, conceding that it is the nature of the game. It is a pastoral game. That it's a rural game. That's how it started. That's what the country was. And you don't have a time limit on baseball, and every time you try to impose one, it's artificial. I kind of think it is what it is. What do you say?
I say the same thing, and I think Joey's answer to his dilemma, we can change around what he put in parentheses, and I could change Joey's statement to this. If baseball makes changes, they won't really make much of a difference. They will change far too much of the actual nature and beauty of the game. I think that's the problem, because generally what happens is games like yesterday's 12-11 game, and I pay particularly close attention to this because obviously they get in the way of my program once in a while, and I've sent notes to John Miller, and I said, you know, John, if the game's going to have to bump me back a little bit, at least you could win the darn game. But I think
three titles in 5 years, man, you're tough. You're tough.
Well,
tough,
you know,
crowd.
They haven't happened lately, so, I, you know, and I wasn't here for those. You know, it's just, what have you done for
That's
me lately,
perfect.
Boy?
That's perfect. I wait 50 years. They went 3-5. 2014's a long time ago. You kids get off of my lawn, right? That's perfect.
Well, I'm
yeah.
a Chicago fan, so I'm bitter
yeah,
about everything.
That's right. There you go. Yeah, there's so the reason for it. Perfect.
I'm just telling you. I think, like with most things, Tony, we tend to notice the things that jump out the most. You know, if there's a line of 100 people and 99 of them are wearing red, the one person who's wearing yellow, our eyes will go to that person. And I think, you know, the reason I mentioned my program is because I can't count how many times my program is scheduled to start late because of the Giants game. And the Giants game has been well under 3 hours. And it's been a game that even when it was a 4-3 or 5-4 game or whatever the case may be, the game has moved along pretty swiftly. But we notice games like yesterday and we immediately say, well, what is the problem of this game? It's no different than in the NBA when you have a game that doesn't go to overtime, but it ends up 128-125 with both teams shooting 45% from three. And immediately we're talking about what are the problems of basketball right now? What do we have to raise the basket? Do we have to change the three-point line? Do we have to lengthen the court? A couple of those things wouldn't be bad, but in terms of the length of a game is what it is. Some games are going to move swiftly. Other games like yesterday, especially when you factor in that it was at Coors Field, it's going to be that way. And I think It's kind of like gymnastics judging, Tony. You need to throw out the high and the low and find where it is in the middle. And are you, as a baseball fan, good with that? For me, I am.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Christopher, I agree with you, and I still think there is a generational issue about this. When I was a kid and we were going to Candlestick or whatever, the earlier the better. One time the Giants and Dodgers were playing what I thought was a 6 o'clock game on Friday night. It turned out to be an 8 o'clock game. By the time the game started, Mom, Dad, and Sis were all back in the car, all right? They'd had enough, okay? To me, I wanted to be there for BP. I wanted to be there for everything. I wanted the game to last as long as possible. But I do understand that over 162, that it can become tedious. And I mentioned this before. My son is of a generation where he just does not have the patience for the game itself. And that's why it is so difficult to figure out, can you tweak the game? And as Joey said, do that, and it probably, we're gonna limit the number of mound visits. Okay, what are we going to shave off of this game? A couple of minutes here or there? I mean, there is nothing you can do, and I'm serious about this, CG, outside of saying, you know what, we're either going to turn the game into a seven-inning game, or we're going to say three balls and two strikes. Unless you're going to do something that's basically going to be in name only the same sport, right? We've got to take the record books and everything, just throw them right. It'd be like turning around in the NFL right now this year and go, you know what we're going to do to simplify pass reception rules? We're going to take the college game and say 1 foot in. Okay, if you did that, CG, what have you just done to the record book in the National Football League? Haven't you essentially changed it forever? Don't you have to just take the record book after all these years and just throw it right out the window? With baseball, yeah. Isn't that what you would do? If you make a real change to placate a generation that doesn't like the nature of the game, aren't you just basically changing it? The only thing that's really the same is the name of the sport, not the way it's played. Yeah. So it kind of is what it is, right?
Yeah. No, you're right, Tony. And I think you're really onto something when you say that this is a generational thing, because, you know, I'll go back to the 100 example. If you line up 100 people in a room, you know, maybe half will like the pitcher's duels. They'll like the 2-1, 3-2 games. And the other half will like the high-scoring games. I fall on the side of the high-scoring games. But where the generational part comes into this is that we have become a bit societally, maybe more than a bit, trying to please everybody. We come up with menus at restaurants that try to please every palate. A steakhouse that used to offer just one other dish that was a chicken dish or a fish dish. Now you'll have an entire page of pastas, chickens, and fish. They want to appeal to everybody. Cable packages. They have 200 to 300 television stations to appeal to everybody. Sports programming does the same thing. We really are dialed into this. Let's make sure that we can keep their attention by going for the full A to Z. And I don't think baseball is that way. It's like James Earl Jones. I watched it with my daughter last weekend. I watched Field of Dreams. And to paraphrase James Earl Jones, he said, you know, but what we've always had baseball has been the constant. And baseball's been around for 100-plus years. The game has only changed relative to the equipment, to the speed of the pitches, to how far balls go when they're hit. Now we have things like exit velocity and launch angle. Well, that's all well and good, but there are plenty of us that are going to the game from a different generation that are very happy to say, yeah, he hit a home run. Sorry, I don't know what the launch angle or exit velocity was. And I think when we try to please everybody to appease multi-generations of fans, I think that's when we start to get into a little bit of trouble.
I agree with you, CG, though I will tell you the flip side of it, and I'm the first one to recognize this. If I'm sitting in Manhattan in those, you know, penthouse offices that they have, right, and I'm Manfred and the boys, and I'm saying, you know what, we need to project 20, 30 years down the line when guys of our generation, never mind they're not watching baseball anymore, they're probably not walking the planet anymore. You will be. I'll be, like I said, I'll be fossil fuel. I'll be feeding the SoCals in the backyard. Trust me. My wife already tries to set me on fire at night, and I tell her, make sure I'm dead before you cremate me. She goes, I think you'll die once I put the flames out. I'm pretty sure you'll be dead. Okay.
Seems a little harsh.
Happy,
okay.
Happy Mother's Day, dear. Anyway, the point is this. If you're looking at the long term, I'm the first to say that while on the one hand I stand by the statement that it is what it is, it's the way the sport is, I also know if I'm the people in charge of trying to make sure this has legs, I'm not worried that, you know, we worry about the NFL, right, because the violence of the game may chase people away from playing it, but we also know there's an unquenchable thirst for the game, right? There's no debate about that. The NBA is riding high right now. Basketball internationally is the sport. No problem there. With baseball, CG, if you're sitting in those offices, what are you saying to yourself about the long term? If you're going to sit and be stubborn and say we can't change anything, then you are eventually going to lose through generations the sport itself. So if a tweak isn't going to work and a major overhaul isn't going to work, what is the in-between ground? Do you have any idea? Is there one?
I would offer this. I'm not against tweaks. I'm really not. But I think when you start to try to make wholesale changes, I think there are always going to be unintended consequences, and you'll have those guys in those penthouse offices in New York City with the great view saying, what have we done? Now we have really unleashed a torrent of things that have screwed things up a bit. Listen, there's nothing wrong with trying to find ways to tweak, but I think you need to get people on board, not just a bunch of guys in suits, but I think you need to get more people than just player association reps from each team. I think you need to have broad meetings with lots of players, even if you have to do giant conference calls. I think you need to get a lot of input before you start making big changes. But, you know, I mean, a couple of the changes that I thought were fine, I think, you know, if they went to a pitch timer, so whatever, I think that would be fine. If they try to keep guys in the box a little bit more, I think that's fine. I think there's a lot of stuff that goes on. Players have gotten so into the guy in the batter's box. Yeah, after each pitch, he steps out of the box. He's got to re-velcro both gloves. He does all the routines. Guys get into these routines. And as a former basketball player, I remember my coach played at Overbrook High School with Wilt Chamberlain, and we had a couple of guys on our team who had all these routines on the foul line, and he said, just shoot the bleeping ball. And his point was, if you're a good shooter, you're not going to have any kind of 20-second rituals. Get up there, a couple of bounces, feel the ball, and shoot it. And I think in baseball, you know, you didn't see Tony Gwynn go through all that. You know, you didn't see Kirby Puckett go through all that. You didn't see those guys do that. They got in the box and they hit the damn ball. And I think today, I don't think that they're doing this in terms of trying to get more TV time, but they get into all these sort of superficial gestures, superstitious gestures as well, or I should say routines, that just enough of all that. And I think that's where, you know, you're talking about a couple of minutes here, a couple of minutes there, and after, if you have, you know, all the batters that come up and every single guy is doing that, eventually that does add up. But if you change some of that, Tony, you're not going to change the fundamental nature of the game. But if you start doing things like putting a guy on second when the game goes into extra innings, that is changing the fundamental nature of the game.
Well, you're right, and that's why yesterday, I think, was an example of a long game that was born of the fact that 23 runs were scored. So I'm not so sure that one is a direct comparison the way Joey Crawford, Mike Hargrove, the human rain delay, remember? was a guy
yeah,
all
sure,
by
yeah.
himself. And I do agree with you. And this is, I think, a cogent point you're making, and that is when I talk about limiting the visits to the mound, okay, yeah, okay, you're going to save a little bit, but there are times when you don't have that many visits anyway. What you're saying about individual at-bats, you are going to mandatorily affect the length of the game then in a positive way, because obviously everybody's going to be up there hacking away. If you can encourage guys to stay in the box, then it's going to help. But the other thing, CG, and I think this is something that maybe the league itself is going to have to come to grips with, you have these monster salaries, and you and I have talked about this so often, but it bears repeating. Almost every league, if you could start all over again, and you could start the league now, then you could do things differently. I said to you before, the draft might not be necessary in the NBA if you actually had a hard cap, a real cap that couldn't be circumvented. to a degree, football the same way. But you can't do that because you've already built in prorated bonuses and all of this stuff, and it would take you years and years to change the structure. Because of that, right now with baseball, the ideal scenario would be what Rizzo said. Let's shorten it to 100 games. CG, if you did that, you know what? The thirst for the game would grow again. But how in the world do you do that with all those local television contracts that are the things that feather the bed for the monster money that goes out? You can't change one without the other, right? You can't shorten the season without shortening the contracts and the money. And that will not be allowed. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and you know that you are preaching to the choir here with that. I would be so much in favor of shortening the season, and what we would see here, the arguments against it, the root, the fundamental root, the baseline of it would be all of these owners and players and managers and coaches not wanting their ultimate pay salary to get cut into, when in fact. So a guy, what happens is a guy suddenly making, because of the TV money as well and everything, the way it's tied together, is a guy suddenly, instead of getting a $25 million a year contract and it goes down to 18 or 17 or 16 or 15, is that insulting him? I think fans, when we've had seasons in sports that have been strike shortened or lockout shortened, when they got back up and running, the season became a magical thing because every game mattered so much more, and you saw players showing a focus and an intensity that was fantastic. If everybody, and I realize that this is almost a moot point because it's likely never going to happen because the genie's out of the bottle, but if they agreed to, okay, we're all going to make a little less, but we're still all going to make enough money for 10 lifetimes, we're shortening the season, we're changing all these contracts, we're going to clean house and do this differently, I think the game would be a better game. I think that, first of all, you'd see less injuries because there'd be less wear and tear on the bodies. Certainly with pitchers, you'd see pitchers throwing less innings, less games, and it would help them immeasurably. I think it would be a great thing, but the problem is nobody wants to give up. You know, if we can make $500 million, why should we settle on just a paltry $300 million? And it's greed. Greed is what has, in many ways, not every way, but in many ways, ruined the game.
I tell you what, we are out of time, and I know we have solved nothing, but Joy, I did want to answer the question, and it won't be the last time we do it. I will leave you at this thought, my friend. You're right. Of course, it would change the record book entirely, so you would have to redraw the whole thing if you had 100-game seasons. But I'm always reminded, it's been my example over the years, when I was at then Sierra Junior High, which has been Duncan Polytechnic for a long time, every school I went to has changed its name and everything's done, right? That's how long ago it's been.
Right.
But we did not have an indoor gym, right? And so because of it, we would complain mightily that we, you know, when it was raining, we couldn't practice, whatever it might be. And we were told, and this was now a junior high that was 7, 8, and 9 at that point, we were told it would take 4 years from fundraising to the building of the gym. And, of course, every seventh grade class would say, exactly what motivation do we have to sacrifice and help fundraise for 3 years for those that come after us? And it's just what you're talking about. What motivation does anybody who's playing the game right now have to give up money to benefit a generation that's coming up at some point with longevity? It plays against human nature, doesn't it?
So. And it does. And I'm going to leave you with one thought before we run here as I look at the clock. Sort of a tease for next week. When it comes to offside in hockey, and I hope Josh is listening, calling offside is not nitpicking. It's a rule. It's in play for a reason. It's written that way for a reason. And just because the guy offside is across the ice, it's called for the same reason that a wide receiver holding a defensive back 30 yards from where the play is happening is also called. We'll talk about that next week, Tony.
Yes, Josh had an email about the chicken bleep call in the Sharks and the Avs. That's what CG's talking about. Christopher,
yeah, Josh,
have a great weekend.
Yeah. All right, you too. I hope Josh does too.
Go Sharks, right? If it were the other way around, you and I would say it's a terribly bogus rule. Am I right about that? No. Blackhawks, maybe? All right, guys. We are done. We will see you on Monday. This is KFIG Fresno.